We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. You'll be glad you did.
It's After Six. Joining us right now, Brent McCall. He's one of the prisoners who's a regular here on the program. Yes, he's a 20-plus year veteran of the state system. Brent, welcome back.
Glad to be here. I always enjoy talking to you, Todd.
So we were chatting off the air, and you said you think that we're in one of those rare moments where change is possible or likely. I'm not sure what exactly your feeling is, but I'd love to hear your ideas on this. As a keen observer of how systems operate, how the prison system operates, and a guy who's written a book on the prison system and its failures, down the rabbit hole, how the culture of corrections encourages crime. So what do you think, Brent?
Well, as far as the cultural moment that we happen to be in here, I think that these moments rarely present themselves. And I think that, you know, we can make significant changes in our society if people can sort of check some of their inherent biases and really open up their views and try to look at things from other people's point of view. Because the fact is that we do live in a society with systemic racism. That doesn't mean that every white person is a racist. It just means that, you know, the system is sort of designed for certain people to fail almost. And
Hold on a sec, because that's such an important distinction. Systemic racism, the phrase gets thrown around a lot, but I don't know if people necessarily understand it. It is the other kind of racism besides personal animus. And I think that the left pushes a false notion that there is a critical problem right now with personal hostilities based on race, where I think it's quite clear that on a personal level, things have never been more calm and accepting than they are right now. And we're on a long trajectory of that improving every year. What's problematic now is the systems that are in place, the political apparatus that requires things not change. And a good example of that is what's going on with the response to the killing of George Floyd, made possible by police unions that have specific policies that insulate cops from responsibility from committing crimes like the killing of George Floyd. So that's an example of systemic racism. And the left, I think, pushes it into personal animus so everyone's distracted by what the true problem is. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in. Go ahead with your point.
No, you're absolutely right about that point. I mean, if you look at the Democratic response to this whole thing, it's they're willing to touch any sort of superficial aspect of it, but not willing to talk about the fundamental problem, which is that bad police officers are protected by unions, and it's almost impossible to do anything to them. The Democrats are pushing notions of, you know, banning chokeholds and things like that. Eric Garner was choked out in New York City when chokeholds were banned. It obviously didn't protect him, and the officers who did it were never held accountable.
You have 1 minute left.
Exactly, yeah. And Derek Chauvin, the killer of George Floyd in Minneapolis, had a body camera on him, so the calls for body camera apparatus on every officer reek of the same problem you're pointing to. All right, check back in with us so we get another fresh 15 minutes, and we'll talk more with Brent McCall on WTIC.
The caller has hung up.
Okay, Brent. Thank you for calling back. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I was just going to say that I think the key to understanding the George Floyd video is just to look at the officer. He seems completely unconcerned with any consequences, you know, ever being implemented in that situation. Like, it doesn't even seem to occur to him that consequences are possible, that he's choking a guy out in the middle of the street. And that's the fundamental problem, is what causes someone to believe that. And clearly,
what do you think?
I think it's clearly the unions, because it's, you know, the unions had, from what I understand, protected him 18 previous times. At what point do you say this guy's not cut out to be a police officer? You know, at what point do the good officers on the Minneapolis Police Department step forward and say, listen, we're not willing to work with this guy? And, you know, this is what we really need in this society, is the good officers to, you know, muster the courage and the will to come forward and say, listen, I'm not going to work with this guy here. He's not cut out to be a police officer. I don't support a union that supports a guy like this. And, you know, this is how you're really going to root this stuff out from the inside.
Yes, but you can't expect that of individuals, I don't think. I mean, there might be some rare, heroic person who's willing to sacrifice his own career, but it would be an unusual expectation and even an unusual ask in an atmosphere where all the power is in the hands of the cabal, of the gangsterism that controls police unions. That is, we know that we can get away with wrong. And I think what you're alluding to is the poignant part of the, or the most poignant part of the George Floyd killing, is the lackadaisical aspect of the behavior of the other cops, the sense that the only behavior that they saw as a viable alternative or a viable response for them as they stood there and watched the killing, the people who are paid to serve and protect by the taxpayers like George Floyd, who is laying there dying at their service and protection. The idea that the system is so diseased that the opposite behavior of what you would expect from a professional law enforcement officer is what is required of them, that's really the heinous aspect of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy to think that cultural sensitivity training could solve a problem like that. To use one example being presented by the liberals, these guys come from the same culture that we come from, and I have enough sense to know that I shouldn't watch somebody choke somebody out in the middle of the street.
Yes, that's about humanity. Either you have some humanity or you don't, but everybody's humanity is called into question when their own physical safety or the safety of their families or the living that they've invested years into being able to earn, when those things are threatened by the people in charge, that's when you bring out the cowardice in people who would otherwise be appropriate and maybe even brave. And that's the tragedy of a diseased system, and that's what a rigged system is. A rigged system is causing a dysfunction in the mechanisms that are supposed to provide correction of course. And it's like you're at the bridge of a ship and you keep telling it to go 10 degrees to the port side, and it just keeps going the same direction, even though the rudder supposedly is being turned.
Yeah. You know, you touched upon the thing that I have the hardest time wrapping my mind around. You know, I've interacted with police officers, correction officers my whole life. I would consider very few of them to be cowardly. But when it comes to that dynamic that you just laid out, it seems like there's very little bravery on their part. I mean, nobody could accuse the officers who chased me down the night I shot Officer Riley and, you know, finally cuffed me up of cowardice. Do you know what I mean? But
yes.
At the same time, they were all seemingly too afraid to come forward and talk about the events that occurred after I was cuffed up. Like, that mm-hmm. was B beyond the pale for them. And I have a hard time understanding how courage works in that way, where you can have courage in one context and, you know, where your life is potentially in danger, and not in another context where it's simply your job that's in danger.
We're talking to Brent McCall, a prisoner in the state prison system and a regular guest here, former cellmate of Michael Leibowitz before they wrote their book together, and then somehow got separated after the book came out about how prisons operate. So, yeah, you know, I think we can look at what you just described, Brent, and say that that is the line between courage and cowardice, that humans are inclined. And by the way, it may even describe the justification for the system as is in the eyes of the people who built it, that if you want to get from police officers maximal courage in those tasks that are really unreasonable to ask of anybody to do, because it means putting your life on the line, it means running towards trouble while others are running away from it, that part of the way they muster that courage is a groupthink and a peer pressure, and also a peer reinforcement that says, we are in this together, we expect each other to run towards the danger, and we support each other 100% when we do that. And I just think it's unfortunate that what's been added into that list of things that have to be supported 100% is the support of an officer who's committing a crime.
Yeah, well, that dynamic you just described is the very dynamic that leads to despotism.
Sorry, say it again. That's the dynamic that what?
Well, that dynamic you just described where, you know, officers, you know, they're courageous in one context and not in another because they, you know, they have these cultural pressures to, think like the group and act like the group and so on and so forth. That leads to despotism. That's the kind of thing that people in a society should fear from the authorities. And this is where the focus needs to be in terms of trying to correct police misconduct and to bring real accountability to law enforcement, whether it be in corrections or on the street.
Well, if you think about that whole idea of bravery and the idea of sticking together as a group, those things are really delicate and really insidious, and there's got to be some way to inspire standards that have more nobility, that require someone to reach down inside of themselves and find their most noble selves. And I wonder what your thoughts are, Brent, on how that can happen. What can you do culturally? Because you're living inside a prison system where I think you see similar kinds of dynamics, where I would suspect that the correctional officers are not even aware of the extent to which they're living in a culture that expects of them to not be consistent in the enforcement of rules and things like that that you pointed out in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think that's largely true, is that they don't give it any thought. But one of the things that Mike and I, you know, because we, in the final chapter of Down the Rabbit Hole, we mentioned briefly the problems with unions and how the unions would be the biggest impediment to changing the system itself. But I think that one of the things that you could do, certainly in corrections, I don't know how it would really work out on the street, but tie results to their earnings. In other words, correction officers should be paid for performance, and that performance should be measured by reductions in recidivism. And I think that would bring a level of consciousness to their work that currently they're lacking.
Well, now you're pointing to, I think, it's inappropriate maybe to have a conversation about the failure of police, who are the ones on the front lines, when they succumb to this kind of corruption, when, in fact, that system of corruption is created by people who don't put themselves on the front lines and don't take personal risk, politicians who simply want to squeeze more power for themselves out of the system that they've sworn to uphold constitutional values, and they do the extreme opposite. So it's politicians who say to the cops, we're all for supporting the cops who violate people's liberties, who actually kill people that they are required to serve and protect. And we're gonna create a system in which that kind of malfeasance can't be fixed. And so let's point a finger at those guys, because this is their contrivance, having this rigged system of the police unions and such.
Oh, absolutely. All the way up the chain, there's, you know, the incentive is essentially to just turn the other cheek. I mean, if you look at what happened with the Hartford State's attorney recently, she was put on leave for 4 days because she neglected to, properly investigate a number of police shootings. And that really is the crux of the issue, is that inertia is the, accountability's antidote. All it requires is good people to do nothing. And if you elect a lot of people that, you know, really lack the character to be representatives of the population, then you sort of get what you asked for.
Well, maybe when you have government, that's what happens. You get what you ask for. That if you create government, I mean, this was the founders' big fear, right? That they knew that the worst thing they could do was to create a government, and yet they felt compelled to do it, and they were trying to figure out how to balance those two realities. And the more I study it, the more I see how government actually works on the insides. When you crawl around in the septic tank of state government and try to deal with the stench,
try living in the belly of the beast.
Yeah, so that's why I like talking to you and Leibowitz about it, because I think you have a more vivid picture in your minds of what this is all about and what the problem is than anybody. But how do you reconcile that with even notions of government at all?
Well, Jefferson, I believe it was, said that the price of freedom is vigilance. So that's what it ultimately requires. It requires a voting public to be very vigilant about what kind of incentives politicians are creating for various authorities, and to take action when, you know, those policies aren't conducive to preserving liberty. I don't think anything short of that would work.
That that almost seems non-responsive to me. If you're creating a government, we can look back and, with the advantage of hindsight, understand that they were being foolish to think that you could build safeguards into a system and that people would always remain vigilant. Why would people remain vigilant? Maybe they couldn't imagine the kind of affluence that America drove into the societies of the world, and in particular into this country. Maybe they couldn't understand living in such comfort that there is no reality that is compelling to the average person about what goes on outside of their own homes. Give us a quick wrap up.
Well, you're probably right about them, lacking the imagination to foresee that. But I think the fundamental principle remains, is that people have to be invested in what their government's doing and understand that, you know, comfort isn't something that's just going to last because it's been around. You know, if history's any indicator, governments only get uglier and uglier.
Yeah, so the challenge is, how do you penetrate the skull of the average person with that? Brent McCall, thank you, sir. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
That's Brent McCall, co-author with Michael Leibowitz, the other prisoner we have on regularly, of Down the Rabbit Hole, How the Culture of Corrections Encourages Crime. Brent and Michael were separated and sent to different prisons after the book came out. And Brent is therefore working on the follow-up book on his own. So we look forward to seeing that when it comes about. That's it for this half hour of After 6. Stay with us as more coming your way on WTIC News Talk 1080.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.